Well, John, thanks for climbing into the buzz bubble. We're going to jump into some questions right off the bat.
Okay.
I appreciate you making some time.
No problem.
Nissan United, global.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a challenge to maintain consistency around the world
right.
with the brand. You know, how does one go about maintaining that consistency from culture to culture? And
well, we're just getting this thing going now. Nissan United was really formed out of a request from Nissan globally and a desire from our perspective. We've been working with Nissan for over 25 years. And it's all within Omnicom with TBWA and OMD and Interbrand and many other companies around the world. And essentially, it's been so decentralized for so many years that the brand stands for something a little bit different in every market.
Right.
And in order to really grow a global brand, in order for your brand to have higher value, and that's really what we're trying to do is build brand value, we really need to find that right kind of consistency. And it has started with things like our tone and manner and our look and feel and VI guidelines and what have you, but it's moving to everything that we do, how we do our investment, how we follow our vision of innovation and excitement, innovation that excites, our brand positioning statements, innovation and excitement for everyone, and how we just start really bringing the world together. So we have teams, we have a headquarters team here, and then teams in all the regions, and people are just working in a far more integrated fashion than ever before. So we got our processes that are bringing all the work and strategies are coming through the center. We're taking a look at it, and it's been the first year, so it's sort of like a learning curve.
So you're in the first year.
Yeah, we're still in the first
wow.
year, but it's an interesting new model that's working great so far. We're seeing the results and starting to see more and more of the regions, both on the client side and the agency side, really working together because everybody realizes a stronger, healthier brand that stands for one singular thing around the world is a better brand, you know, for all of us. So we're excited about that.
Do you have an example of something that you discovered because it worked elsewhere that was brought here? You know, that's I assume that's one of the benefits is, well, this is working in Japan or
yeah.
somewhere in Europe, and you said, well, let's try that in the States, and lo and behold, it worked.
It's actually interesting. It's one of those things, well, why couldn't we just do one ad and run it everywhere? And it's really pretty hard to do that because Japan's very different than Brazil. It's very
right.
different than South Africa. It's very different than Thailand. And because of the long histories of the brands operating relatively independent in each country, it's not easy just to sort of say, oh, well, just all get together and do this. So, but we have found, I mean, as part of what we're doing is globally, we look at, you know, we know how many ads we're going to do for Juke around the world this year and how many
wow.
people have asked or how many countries wanted to do one. But we're looking and saying, you know what, if you guys get together, for instance, or we do this one here, you could use it there. I mean, Juke. There's a great ad that was done in the Europe over the last year, and the U.S. picked it up this year. So,
oh, wow.
And there's work that's been picked up, you know, in different parts out of the U.S. to other parts of the world. And Australia's doing some of the best work right now, and some of that work's being exported. But really, it starts with a singular brand strategy, a singular big idea, and then how is that executed? So it's all through tone of voice to grab that, you know, try to create that consistency. And we're in the process, but it's we've accomplished a lot, but we have so much further to go.
Yeah, it sounds like more than a one-year project.
yeah, I think so. You know, one of the things that we're working on right now, which is kind of interesting, is really this tone of voice. What is our tone of voice? And if you take a look at some of the best brands around the world, and I worked on Volkswagen for about 10 years in a previous life, you know, to me, if you look at an ad for Volkswagen anywhere in the world, it seems like there's like one copywriter in the world who's sitting in a room writing every ad. Because it sounds the same, it feels the same, you know it's a Volkswagen ad. I think
yeah.
Harley Davidson has that same consistency. And it's the look, it's the language, it's the
and
tone of voice.
Globally, too.
Globally,
not,
yeah, if globally. Wow. You take an ad, Axe, take a look at Axe. I mean, they have a singular proposition. You know, if you, as a young male, spray this stuff on you, you know what's going to happen, right?
Right.
So, and it's expressed.
Pretty universal.
It's a universal message. But we've taken a look at, as we've been studying this, we've taken a look at their work, you know, from the U.S., from Latin America, from, you know, South Africa, from around the world, and wow, you feel like it's one brand. I mean, right now and historically for Nissan, you know, admittedly, I would say, and TBWA is the agency around the world, but if you look at Nissan around the world, there's a lot of different copywriters. There's not just one copywriter. Sure, sure. So as we are, that's one of the big projects we're working on right now as we're bringing it closer together. How do we find and how do we use the same voice? Doesn't mean it has to be the same ad or the same voiceover or the same construct, but how does a Nissan ad feel like a Nissan ad? Or how does a Nissan experience, I should probably say, feel like a Nissan experience? So it's not just advertising, it's in the stores, with the dealers, with the way the loyalty programs work. They're doing on the product side. I mean, Nissan's doing an amazing job. How does a Nissan drive? You know, they can turn this dial or turn that dial. It can be harder, it can be softer rides. What's the Nissan way? So a lot of these companies are doing this, behind the scenes, and we're trying to engineer, if you will, the brand to also communicate and itself in a particular way like that.
Is there a global brief? I'm sure there's a North America brief. Is there a goal to have one brief that everybody can get around?
Well,
or is that too much? That's kind of
I think that there are some global brand briefs. I mean, we're in the process of doing a new brand expression globally that will be a. And it's hard to do those that are going to work around the world and still not be
the
vanilla.
Target's different.
Right? But if you for instance, there's the next Frontier Navara. It's a product that's in many parts of the world, is coming out. It first launches in Thailand, then it goes to Australia, then I think it's in Mexico, all before it gets to a market like the U.S. where the Frontier is huge. So, historically we'd have, Thailand would be working locally and they'd do all their ads. And nobody in global would see them, and then Australia would do theirs, and then Mexico would do theirs, and maybe they do need to have different executions. But why don't we have a singular strategy? What's a singular brand idea that might be executed in different ways?
Right.
That's kind of the next step of where we're headed. But more global. It's not like global control or global takeover, but just more global discipline, more consistency. So that the brand truly can stand for something more than just a product in an individual market.
Right. At the Buzz Bubble, we always follow the great work. So I'm a huge, huge Leaf fan. I'm a Leaf driver, a fanatic. It was the gas-powered everything TV spot that got me, and happy birthday TV spot that closed the deal for me. I was like, oh, it's been a year. Viable. It's here. Well, I'm going to get one tomorrow.
Yeah.
So what's the climate around the EV? I don't know, some of them call it the car wars. What's the climate around that right now?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I'm a fanatic myself. I was one of the first people in Tennessee that got one. I think the governor got one before I did. I was living in Tennessee at the time, but I had my VIN number. It's the VIN number 00000325. So I was like, I've got the 325th one. And I got to tell you, I was a believer, and I think it's one of those, the for 100% electric, I am such a believer in the product, and it's so surprising. And the reaction has been the same. I think you probably, we've talked a little bit about it, but I love getting people. I got my CEO in the car for the first time, and a couple of other big guys. And so there were four of us, maybe it was five of us, but we were in the car.
Sitting comfortably, everybody's always surprised.
Just going, he's like, turn it on. Oh, it's on, and you start going like, oh, this is nice, and everybody has that expectation. Then you put down the accelerator, get that torque going, and suddenly you're going slightly more than the speed limit down the highway.
And like you get there quickly.
And they're like, wait a second, and he was surprised. It's a product it's fun to drive, and it's one of those you have to experience. I mean, I think it's kind of like when people first heard about an iPhone, they're like, oh, or a smartphone, what's this? And then when you experience, you're like, oh my God, I got to have it. Now, Leaf and EVs, 100% EVs anyway, have, it's one of those barriers to change. Is it expense? Is it range anxiety? But I think as you see, Nissan Renault just sold its 100,000th EV last month. 100,000. Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah.
The Smyrna plant is the largest battery plant in the world now, down in Tennessee. The investment's there, and you can begin to see right here in the States, which has brought the cost down as opposed to bringing it, out of Japan.
And I get all the naysayers, and they say, well, the footprint of bringing those batteries over on the diesel powered, it's right here.
Yeah, it's here. I mean, listen, I think that everything in the world. I mean, when you come to pure green, I mean, okay, just ride your bike, okay? I think the reality is a lot of the people did it initially, the very earliest adopters wanted it for that green factor and that badge and what have you, but But it's a viable car otherwise.
I mean, oh, and, yeah. My and it's daughter, not a station car. I mean, people say, oh, is that your station car? No, I drive
it every day.
Live in Long Island, I have a client in Fort Lee, and mm-hmm. go back, and yeah, it's great.
Yeah. You know. I mean, it's not for people who are going 200 miles a day. I mean, it's really refining, it's two car families or two car people in the United States. It's different in Japan, it's different in Europe. In Norway, a couple of months ago, it was the second best selling car behind the Volkswagen Golf, an EV. They have great incentives, they're very progressive from an environmental perspective, but really, we've moved away from that environmental conversation. You talk about gas-powered everything. You talked about the happy birthday, the journey,
polar bear
journey to zero. That was very early adopter. That's really not the message because everybody wants that, knows that already.
Right.
At this point, it's that. How does it fit into your everyday life? And oh, by the way, it's really exciting and fun to drive.
Fun. Yeah, there's no compromise.
My daughter learned to drive. On the Leaf.
Me too.
Got her license. So she only drove EV until she had to get something else. And she wasn't going to drive a Leaf because she wanted.
I'm not letting her drive my Leaf. My daughter took the test, but she's scared.
Yeah.
I got something else.
It was funny because this past weekend she just, because part of the deal is
for me.
I said, you have to buy your own gas. I'm not buying the gas for your vehicle.
Yeah.
And that was, I was like, if you want to have a Leaf, you get free electricity at home. And of course, for her, I thought that was an advantage. And for me, I knew she wasn't going to go three states away.
Right.
Not quickly, anyway. So she texted me a note that said, I'm so sad, and took a picture of her first gas receipt. It was like $78. And I said, you should have gotten the Leaf. She's like, well, all right. And
I like the not having to go to a gas station.
Yeah.
You know, I come home, I plug in my car, and I go in the house, you know?
Everybody needs their story. I mean, a friend of mine bought one of the luxury Teslas, you know, and he's got the means to do it. It's a great-looking car. It's expensive because it has many more batteries. That's why it can go 300 miles. But he says, John, his valuable commodity is time. He does travel. He says, listen, the amount of time, 10 or 15 minutes at the gas station, the amount of time I travel, I figured out it was like 6 or 7 days of my life, and I calculated that out as how much money I'm making when I'm on the road.
Yeah.
And he realized that was his rationalization. But really, when you get to EV, is it yes or no? Is it going to be a success or not a success? I think you can see this happening. And the tipping point is on its way. Yes, cost remains a factor, and you know, are you going to get, you know, when can you make a Leaf, you know, go 300 miles? Well, you can't. I mean, you can put more batteries in it.
That's what I was going to say. You just put more batteries.
Because
but it's not practical.
The best example for me was someone said, a computer used to be this big and now it's this big.
Right.
It's because it's technology based. But this is chemistry. Batteries are chemistry. So each of the batteries is so big, they're only going to be able to get it so much more efficient and smaller weight. But they're not going to be able to make it this big, so you can just power your Leaf on a battery this big.
Right.
So it's not going to happen. But I think that the acceptance is there, and the more people that drive them, they go, wow, I can't believe it. As the price point has come down, that's going to make it better. More competitors in the market, it's going to bring more acceptance. And I think it is definitely going to be on its way. And I think there's a lot of discussion as to 100% electric versus like the Volt, which is I'll call it a compromise.
You guys took a direct stab at it with the gas-powered everything, which I love.
Yeah.
You know, let's not beat around the bush.
But I think that, you know, that's it's $10,000 more for basically a hybrid in many ways.
Right.
Now, I'd say get a Prius. They're darn good cars. Now, listen, they're 100% electric for 30 or 35 miles, and then it's a backup, with the backup power plant. But why carry two power plants with you is kind of what I look at.
I love that they don't qualify for the HOV in Long Island because they are the gas-powered engine on it. Is not efficient enough,
not
so they don't qualify.
Listen, I think there's lots.
I
applaud them for, everybody's trying different things to find out where the market's at. So but for me, I do think electric, 100% electric, you know, it's bound to continue to improve. But
if you're a family, you know, one of my rationalizations was, okay, well, if I have a big trip, switch the wife. She's got a short trip, relatively.
Yeah.
We don't switch. I mean, I rarely switch.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is another safety valve. If you know, it's a good family car because if you've, and it's made me a thoughtful driver.
which I think about what I'm doing, mm-hmm. think about my day, and I needed that. I was I was getting 5 tickets a year and driving a 6-speed supercharged Mini mm-hmm. Cooper, and so this was the perfect car for me, and it's fun.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I've got plenty of friends who, one in particular I saw pulled over in his Leaf on the side of the road by, he's going a little fast.
These things are, people ask me,
yeah,
how fast does it go?
Yeah.
And I say, it goes 100 here.
Yeah.
Rumor has it. One last thing on that whole scene. We're in New York City, and Nissan has got pioneering a hybrid program with the cabs and some EV programs.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I'll tell you, it's really exciting because Nissan was, named Taxi of Tomorrow, which I think it's actually on one of these things here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So that's the taxi. And in fact, that was part of our brand campaign. What if a car could take over New York City? So the NV200 New York Taxi. This thing's great, by the way. It's got all the things that you hate about the current taxis out there. You've got room for five, you can only put one in the front, three. You've got ports in the back for your iPod, you've got a roof that's glass so you actually can get in and look up and see the skyscrapers, antibacterial seats. I mean, it's really quite, one of the cool things is I think that there's 13,500 taxis, something like that, in New York City, and if you replaced every traditional taxi with this, the footprint will save across the city of New York something the size of Central Park. I mean, it's a significant amount of safety.
Wow.
So now it gets rolled out. People aren't going to, people have to start taking them on there. But it's really great. Again, just like Leaf in general, it's a great brand statement for Nissan.
Right.
Right now they're piloting 6 Leafs that are going around the city as a pilot program.
Right, right.
And there's a great article I read just a few weeks ago, an interview with one of the guys who has it. I think it's a program, he rents it he's renting it for $1 for the year in exchange for, and he says, listen, I have to stop and I go to the quick start station, so I got to take 15 minutes out of fares, and I plan if I'm going to go to the, from downtown to the airports and what have you. But he says, I make a little bit less in my fares because I'm going a little less far, but the tips are a whole lot better because it's such a great experience. And he's not paying for gas.
Right.
So the net is that he's actually making a little bit more money.
And it's really efficient on the local streets, I find.
It is. Well, and the fact is
I've
you've
seen
got
the number go up as I've been driving.
Locally. You find, I think, and again, you take a look at the computer systems and they're gauging your efficiency and how much battery you have left and, how do you optimize your driving? I mean, it's really smart. It's intuitive. It thinks ahead for you, and they keep improving those computer programs. So it's, I think the test is going to be great and show that it's actually viable. Listen, it's configured a little bit differently. It's a hatchback, four-door. This is, the taxi of tomorrow will be, it's like a small van with a lot more room in it. So, if you get off the airplane with one of those massive things, you're not going to throw it in the back of the taxi. But it's, again, it's the test for the technology,
right.
which the technology of electric and even hybrid can go into various vehicles. So it's all being
Fantastic.
Studied, but it's really cool.
Love it. Let's talk a little bit about the changing agency model.
Yeah.
You had to single out the number one challenge, and of course, we would like to hear a remedy, a solution. So what's one of the biggest challenges in this changing agency model that we have, the evolution of what we're all doing when we get here in the morning?
I guess my vantage point now is really of working with global clients.
Right.
And so, and really the global client, what I think is kind of interesting now is I started the business, a million years ago, which you can tell by the beard, which I would have shaved off, but I just got back from vacation. I'd have tan lines like here. It would have looked a little odd. So
planning, but I would have done the same thing.
So, but back in the day, it was listen. It's a full service agency model. You're all under one roof, and I've got my. Of course, you had your account people, your creative people, and your media people, and that's what you had. Maybe you had a little PR over here, maybe you had a little design over here, but that was your core agency model. And then, through specialization, consolidation, client desire for for specialization. All of a sudden everything got sort of unbundled, right?
Right.
And so media agencies became specialized, you know, digital agencies cropped up and became specialized, and design agencies and direct marketing agencies, and you know, everybody all sort of got separated. But what I'm seeing is, and I feel it all the time, is that they really, the clients that I'm seeing really are saying, hey, wait, I want the benefits of the specialization, but I want you all to work together.
Right. Integration.
And it's kind of that integration and come on, you know, come on back and all work together. I mean, that's basically the model that we're doing at Nissan United, is that we have people from TBWA focused on content. We've got people from OMD focused on investment and targeting and media. We have people from M&8 who are focused on public relations. And we have people from Interbrand who are brand strategists and brand engineers. We have people from lots of different disciplines. They are all Omnicom, but what they do is they have an office here, and we are here multiple days a week. We talk on the phone if we're not together. We have phone calls together. We work together. We're looking at things together. We're proposing ideas together. So it's like one team. Yet each of the individuals are going back to their agency and are there on a Monday or a Friday or, you know, half a day here. And so they're still gaining that expertise. So they're not siloed. I mean, some of the models I've seen, you know, you got 1,200 people in a building dedicated to the client across the street. We won't name names in Detroit, but that's great for integration and communication and client service, but are the individuals really able to be going back to this touchstone? And so I think we have a bit of a hybrid model where we're not all sequestered in one building and not growing in our respective fields and gathering information and bringing new ideas in. And we're not all, you know, separate and never getting together. So this is a good hybrid model that I think, and I think that's what clients want. I mean, the clients are expecting through Nissan United globally, you guys figure it out. You have an issue over here, you figure it out. You got an issue over here, you figure it out. So we're doing it within Omnicom, but I had a couple of meetings earlier today with a company that works on the motor shows, and they've said to this motor show company, hey, can you guys have to go through Nissan United? And we had a great meeting, it was right before you came in, talking about what we're doing, and they're like, wow, this is what we're doing, but we'll take some of this. And all of a sudden, what's going to happen in Frankfurt in a few weeks is the clients are all going to be there. They know that we're getting together, but they're going to go, wow, look at how it's all worked together.
Right.
Got to make it seamless behind the scenes, make it easy. Clients are wanting us to help solve those problems of integration so they don't have to do it. And it's harder for them to do it. They've got enough challenges.
Yeah, so. Right. So specialty and integration, not exclusive. So New York City, L.A., I heard Rob might be in the house, but I love to talk agency culture, you know, and I know how often you get out there. I know you came from Nashville and you've been here for
a year.
What's your take on, you know, the bi-coastal agency and the differences in the agency cultures?
Well, it's interesting. I never worked in the LA office. I mean, I would go out there quite a bit, but I was living in Nashville. Most of the team was actually in LA, so I would go out there once every 4 weeks or so, or 3 weeks or 5 weeks or whatever, and be with the team, and I mean, I love the LA culture. That office out there is fantastic. It's big, it's wide open, it's very creative. It's, you know, maybe come in a little bit later, definitely stay a whole lot later, and it's a great culture out there. In New York, and again, I don't feel like I actually work in the New York office of TBWA. I mean, I am in some of their space, but Nissan United is really carved out to be its own entity. I mean, we've got TBWA corporate, and then Chiat Day New York is upstairs. TBWA New York is upstairs, and so I really haven't spent much time in the agency. But I guess what I've noticed is people are I don't know. It just feels like there's a little bit more going on. You're getting a lot more done, a lot quicker.
Yeah.
And it's just not as, it's a little more relaxed. It's a different pace. It's not
it's
like
a different pace.
It's just a different
it's
pace.
Not right so, or wrong.
Well, I think both
it's
work.
Just
I mean,
fit for each person. I love LA. I love the vibe.
Yeah.
I'm there 10 days. I gotta get out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a Boston guy originally. I grew up at Arnold in Boston, and it was a very familial feeling. It was a very nice place. We had a lot of great clients from the Midwest because I think we had a really easygoing, nice way. I mean, creative way, strategic, smart, but really nice. Culture. So that's, I mean, every agency's got its own culture, but sometimes I think it is city dependent. But I've only been here a year. I swore I'd never live in New York. I guess I don't live here, but I'm having a good time. It's pretty cool here. I like it a lot.
Good to be a New Yorker. Okay, so
One of our challenges is to contour, let's say, popular opinion and outlook of culture. So have you seen anything that a brand agency partnership can do to accelerate cultural perspective modification, or what do you want to call it? Just popular opinion?
We're going to change popular opinion through the work that we do. Is that what you mean?
That's what they told me when I got into advertising. They told me I was going to change the world, and I was like,
shoot,
sign me up.
I thought we were just selling stuff. I feel that the best communications, and again, I don't even want to call it advertising anymore, but the best content, best communications, is oftentimes a reflection on what's happening in culture. Right. And maybe articulated, re-articulated in a way that is relevant for whatever the brand is. But I think the world is, you know, it used to be that agencies and agency work, I think, was driving a lot of popular opinion or cultural opinion. I think it's just because of social media, it's changing so much. I mean, the individuals who are, you know, posting and living brands every single day out there on their Facebook, Twitter, you know, LinkedIn, Vine, Instagram, Pinterest, whatever it is, that is so much a part of what's shaping people's
right.
opinion. And I think that I've always felt that the best advertising is word of mouth, right? So
sure.
you believe, you know, you may not believe a company or an advertisement or but you're going to believe what your friend has to say or what someone you trust has to say. And I think that that's changing and shifting popular opinion and culture more than brands are. I think brands still are able to do it, but the brands that are most successful are the ones that are listening and are most in tune and then riding the wave and maybe finding their own way to fit into it.
Do you think it's pushed transparency? So, you know, we all kind of, they say, be careful what you wish for. We kind of got it. We always mm-hmm. wanted to be in front of them, integrated into their life. Now we're there. We're in the conversation, and it better be good. It better mm-hmm. be sincere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that conversation of transparency, depending on what department you're talking to in the brand side, it can be difficult.
Well, I mean, I think it's holding brands' feet to the fire, right? I mean, you can't hide behind corporate speak. You can't hide behind just an ad. You can't hide behind the press release.
Yeah.
I mean, it's being decided for you. And if you, and I think the brands, again, that are being most successful are the ones that recognize and understand it, appreciate it, and are willing to engage on the terms that are set by the public. We can't get out there and tell you, we're going to tell you exactly what kind of, you know, dishwasher fluid to buy or whatever.
Right.
I mean, we're not telling them anymore, but we can find ways to help, you know, be a part of that conversation. And again, consumers are far too savvy now to,
right.
You know, just to be told, yeah,
being told.
Manipulated. So I'm with you on that. I think it's something that's changing. And again, the ones that are, they recognize what's happening in the world. They're recognizing what's happening with their potential customers. They're recognizing where their brand truly sits, and they're being true to them. You know, the brands are being true to themselves and find their way to fit in. Some brands are arrogant. Some brands are confident. Some brands, you know, what's their voice and what's the voice they want to portray, no matter where it is. How do you respond to a crisis? How do you respond to some negative feedback that comes in? What if you screw up? I mean, listen, companies make a mistake.
Right.
How do you handle that? I mean, you see a lot of brands handling that latest tax crisis, for instance. You know, you're actually hiding taxes by being off overseas.
Oh,
and
yeah,
a
sure.
lot of different companies have done that. So how do they handle it? How does the brand handle it? We're not going to deal with it. We've done nothing wrong. We want to do something to address it. We haven't done anything illegal, but here's something that we would like to do to show our commitment. I mean, how brands act are really going to make, you know, make consumers understand what they're really all about.
Yeah, yeah. The curtain's pulled back. There's no hiding behind it.
No kimono, no more.
That's right. So you talked about Arnold. Let's jump into a little about John. And what was your first break in the ad biz? And maybe what was your first ad?
So I was in college. I was in English major and a French and philosophy minor. So I was really headed towards a very smart career. I had no idea what I was going to do. But I, in high school and college, I worked at McDonald's
okay.
to put myself through college. And it was about my junior year. I said, I don't want to be an English teacher when I grow up. But you know what? I like to write. And I saw an ad on TV for McDonald's. I'm like, hey, I can do that. I could write that. So I went to I went to my store manager, and I was, you know, I would open the stores, and I'd been working for the same company for 5 years, and I said, hey, could you maybe introduce me to somebody? I'd like to learn more about advertising. They said, sure, John, but we really want you to be a store manager when you graduate. You can be doing great. You can make a lot of money. I said, yeah, but can you introduce me? And so I went to a co-op meeting, and it was when Arnold and Company introduced salads to the co-ops. And so I sat there and I watched as they played the TV spots and everybody's on stage and doing all the theatrics. I'm like, that is great. I want to do that. What do you want to do? Oh, I want to be a copywriter. So they set me up to, it was after my junior year, to go and meet a copywriter. Scott Ramsden, I remember the guy's name. We didn't work together for too long, but he said, so, you know, here's something I do. And he pulled out a billboard, and it was the McDonald's M logo.
Yeah.
It was M-M-M-M-M. And it just won OBs and FEs and cans and everything around the world.
Oh,
he's like,
well,
I just did this and all this metal. And I'm looking at him like, okay, so I can't do that. So I went over and became an account guy. I got an internship during my senior year. I come down on the Greyhound bus from UNH 2 days a week to Boston. And would work. I worked in the new business group, and just had a lot of fun. And they offered me a job when I was graduating. And so then I jumped into Arnold, and I was there for a better part of 20 years. And probably my first ad. It had something to do with Blue Cross and Blue Shield, because when I was in new business as an intern, I participated and they won the pitch. And then when I got there, I was assigned to Blue Cross and Blue Shield. So it was probably a print ad for HMO Blue. They were introducing their first HMO. So yeah, that was probably the first ad.
What was your favorite ad?
Of all time?
Of your own.
Of my own?
Some part in.
Well, present company excluded, maybe.
Historically,
one of my favorite ads is behind the sign. I was working on Volkswagen, and the Jerry Garcia had passed away.
Oh,
and
wow.
Our creative guys, Lance Jensen, Alan Poffenbach, and Ron Lawner were, you know, sitting around talking, and they're talking about Jerry Garcia, and they just sort of talked about it. I mean, I wasn't there, but they talked about it, and, you know, Alan is a great guy. He sketched it out, and Lance had an idea for it. It was very simple. Jerry Garcia, his birth date, and then with just the teardrop underneath the front of that bus. And I'm
classic,
like, you know what? That was great. And it was one of those ones that can't, you know, I may have died on a Monday or a Tuesday, came up with the ad on a Tuesday.
Wow.
And client said, go do it, and we had it illustrated, and it was in the following weeks. I think we were Entertainment Weekly and Rolling Stone magazine, boom. And it was just like,
wow.
You know, that was a magical ad. I think a lot of the era of work that Volkswagen did in the late 90s, really helping that brand, really, really was great for car advertising and for that brand. So I was fortunate to be a part of that. You know, I think some of the Leaf work that we've done most recently is exciting. And some of the stuff coming down the pike will make my top 10.
Okay. How about the worst ad? Do you remember, you know, going, oh, man, I can't believe I just did that.
Well, I would say, whoo. All right, see, how many clients can I offend here?
No,
better
no,
than
yeah,
that. Well, I would say that.
Doesn't have to be one that made it. I
will say that there have been a couple of ads in my former life that I was like, oh gosh, I can't believe that we ended up doing that. But I'll say anything that feels like the strategy is showing that it's been dictated. And I mean, like, so much of the conventional running footage, USP, multi-offer car spots that are out there today, that, you know, all brands do at some point, seemingly do at some point. I just think that's not good for the brand. Customers aren't listening to you yell at them. I mean, so I've been a part of some of that, you know, maybe reluctantly, but I'm not proud of any of that kind of work that gets done.
Good answer. If you couldn't be an ad guy, what would you be doing? What do you think is career number two or the other career? And I don't think it's McDonald's manager.
Well, they said they'd start me off at $30,000 a year. And instead I decided advertising
for
18.
You'd probably be up to 36 by now.
No, I would be. I would be. And I you know, in advertising, as we know, doesn't pay that well. But I would say, what else would I do? I mean, I have no musical talent. I would love to actually be in a rock and roll band, but I probably would flame out quickly.
I did that, now I'm an advertiser.
Oh, there you go. So it works the other way, yeah. I probably would be an antique auctioneer. I actually grew up, my grandparents were antique dealers. I loved going to auctions. I loved the theatrical part of what they do, engaging the audience, and you're selling.
You're selling, yeah.
And even though I once did a small job during the summertime trying to sell. I mean, I did it for 2 weeks. So miserable. I said, I hate sales. I'll never be in sales. I guess I am in sales, right?
Yeah, we're all in sales. But yeah,
I would probably be an antiques auctioneer.
Fair enough. Let's jump into the buzz round, because I think you did a great job addressing the digital part.
Buzz round.
So, buzz round.
The buzz round.
Rapid fire questions. So, here we go. You ready?
I am.
What's the most overused word in the ad game?
Impactful.
Okay. What's your favorite ad that somebody else did? And I'm giving you license to say whatever you want, not that I have any power.
Okay. I have to say that some of the earliest Volkswagen work from the 60s to me stands as the test of time as some of the best communications of all time.
Great. Ginger or Marianne?
Marianne.
Okay. See, yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
I'm with you. Three personal passions, if you had to, you know, you're just on vacation. Did you chase any of those passions?
I like whiskey.
Okay.
That's good. I got some whiskey over there. I like salty meats. I'm a big fan I like trying different kinds of cured sausage. Well, you know, like the hard sausages.
Ooh, yeah.
You try to find those anywhere I can go. Castle advertising signs. I have a bunch of antique castle advertising signs here in my home office. So that's a big passion. I try to find them all the time. That's out of India, as a matter of fact. So
very cool.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Steak or tofu?
Steak.
Okay.
What's
I got
tofu?
A different answer usually on the other coast. What should it say on your tombstone? Now I'm asking you to be a copywriter.
Copywriter? Well, a tombstone. That's a long way away.
Yeah. Right.
That was a good 100 years.
Fair enough. Okay.
Let's hope I make it that far. I have the salty meats and scotch. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Here lies.
No. Yeah, exactly.
So you're a fireman.
Yep.
Driving the engine or in the back steering the ladder?
God, this is like some psychology test.
I think the
steering the ladder would be actually more fun. I'm a driver of the engine, but boy, steering that ladder takes a little bit more. I want to be out there. You're flying around. I'm going to steer the ladder.
I like that. And the final one, what would be your theme song, if you had one?
Theme song?
Yes, John Castle theme song.
Oh boy, Dream On. I don't know, let's see.
Boston.
Now maybe that's about as well as I can do. There's probably a James Taylor story in there somewhere. I like his copywriting, so to speak. So.
Fair enough.
Hey, I got a question for you.
Sure.
Okay.
I don't have a theme song.
You're gonna have to use this one. In the history, you can choose any three musicians to go see live, bands, individual, whatever, of all time. Who would the three be?
Dead or alive?
Dead or alive?
Oh, Zeppelin with Bonzo. I'm a huge John Bonham fan.
Yeah.
I'm probably gonna go back to that era and say they're all gonna be dead.
It's just that's okay. Dead's okay. That was an open question.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yep.
And number three. The Beatles together.
Yeah.
The Beatles as a band.
So I'm good with you on Hendrix.
Okay.
I'd have to go see Miles Davis with Coltrane.
Wow.
That is, unbelievably have to do that. And why wouldn't you go see Mozart? Come on, Mozart would be pretty cool. Or Beethoven, one of those guys?
Come on. I know. And I'm with you. I love classical music. I'm just thinking, you know, I'm a fidelity guy and I'm wondering how it sounded back then.
Oh, that harpsichord playing.
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
All right. Amadeus. Another dead guy. We love the dead guys, right? John, thanks so much. It was a real pleasure.
All right, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate it.
Buzz Bubble out.